For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, which is in Luke chapter 5. Toward the end of Luke 5 is where we left off. And I just want to remind you that we're early, very early in Jesus' public ministry. And we saw last week that very early on, almost from the beginning, Jesus' public ministry attracted the scrutiny of the religious leaders of Israel. And very early on, he attracted their criticism. And you will see in this passage this morning how this criticism takes shape in several conflicts between Jesus and actually a certain group of religious leaders known as the Pharisees. And you'll also see how quickly this conflict escalates to the point where they decide that Jesus has to be eliminated. And it raises the obvious question, you know, what's the reason for this implacable enmity between these leaders and Jesus? Because on the one hand, they had an awful lot in common. They were from the Jewish nation, and so they shared a common heritage. They shared a common monotheism, the belief in the one true personal righteous God. They both subscribed to the Old Testament as God's inspired word. So there's all kinds of common ground between Jesus and these religious leaders. But they parted company on a couple of really key issues. One we saw last week. And the issue was how they viewed the irreligious. Because the Pharisees, and the term Pharisee means the separated ones, they viewed the irreligious people in that society as unclean people who were full of sin cooties that you just wanted to stay as far away from as possible. And Jesus, on the other hand, said, my whole mission is to reach out to the irreligious people and to heal them and to help them and to reconcile them to God and to call them to join me in my mission to go reach out to more people like them. And so they were at loggerheads on that issue. The other distinct but related place that they disagreed had to do with Jesus' non-compliance with the Pharisees' religious traditions. As you'll see, they had all kinds of religious rules. I mean, they were the religious rule nuts. And Jesus, you know, just walks through life breaking their rules all over the place. And when they point it out to him, he doesn't apologize. And so this passage that we're going to look at, it begins at toward the end of Luke 5 and goes through the first part of Luke 6. Luke narrates three conflicts over Jesus and these rules. And I want you to watch to see how they escalate. The first one is fairly tame. The religious leaders simply lodge a complaint to Jesus. And it starts in chapter 5, verse 33. I'm reading from the New Living. It says, the religious leaders complained that Jesus' disciples were feasting instead of fasting. You may remember last week that he was out having a dinner party with some tax collector and his friends. Well, they said, John the Baptist's disciples always fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees. Why are yours always feasting? I mean, right off the bat, I like where Jesus is at compared to where they're at, but that's a different issue. Okay. You see right away that the religious leaders really thought fasting was a key feature of personal piety. Some of it comes from the Old Testament. The Old Testament did prescribe one day of fasting per year on the Day of Atonement. And in addition, if you read through the Old Testament, a lot of times when God's people were mourning or when they were praying for deliverance, they would accompany that with going without food. Now, John the Baptist's disciples were doing a lot of fasting these days because by now John had been arrested by Herod, and so they were mourning his imprisonment and praying for his deliverance. But the Pharisees went way, way farther with the whole idea of fasting. For them, fasting was like one of the preeminent features of spirituality. They fasted every week, twice a week. I forget whether it's Tuesday and Friday or Monday and Thursday, but they fasted from sunup to sundown every 2 days a week. And they made a big, huge deal out of this. And so they are aghast that this rabbi who claims to speak for God, he just doesn't fast at all. And his friends, they're all the time eating at parties. They never fast. So it's a complaint. Here's how Jesus responds. First, he responds to the notion of John the Baptist's disciples fasting. He says, you know, do wedding guests fast while celebrating with the groom? And so his point is, look, I can understand why John the Baptist's disciples would be fasting because they've been separated from their teacher. But likening himself to the bridegroom and his disciples to wedding guests, he's like, I'm here and they're with me and this is a joyous occasion. So why? It's inappropriate for them to be fasting when they're in my presence. And that sort of implies that Jesus has a high view of himself, doesn't it? In fact, his reference to himself as the bridegroom is an allusion to Isaiah 61, which speaks of the Messiah as the bridegroom. He says, now the day will come when he, the bridegroom, Jesus, will be taken away from them, the wedding guests, his disciples. And by the way, the verb taken away doesn't fit the wedding analogy. Because in a wedding, when the wedding reception's over, people aren't grabbed and forcibly taken home. But he says, the day is coming when I'm going to be grabbed and forcibly ripped away from my disciples. This is Jesus' first reference to the fact that he knew that he would be arrested and crucified. He says, then they'll mourn. They'll mourn because of their sadness and they'll fast. Then he goes on and ups the ante. And he says, I'll tell you another reason why we don't fast. He gave them two illustrations. No one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and uses it to patch the old garment, because then the new garment would be torn and the patch wouldn't even match the old garment. He says, no one. Not no one. I mean, in my hippie days, I did this. In my hippie days, you know, everyone kept your blue jeans until they almost fell off of your body. And so when the seat would tear out or whatever, my seat tore out. And so I got a nice new piece of blue denim and patched into my old jeans and totally destroyed that pair of jeans, because when it got washed, which wasn't often, the new piece shrunk and tore the seat completely out. No one except me. But you see his point. And he says, here's another illustration. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, because the new wine would then burst the old skins, spilling the wine and ruining the skins. In that day, they put wine while it was still fermenting into wineskins. So it was imperative that you put new wine into new wineskins, which were still supple, so that when the fermentation process took place and the gases expanded the skin, there was elasticity in the skin to hold the wine. If you put new wine into old brittle wineskins, it would blow them up. That'd be a mess. And you lose your wine and you lose your skins. Now, what is he saying here? This is a remarkable statement. You see what he's saying is, guys, I'm not here as one more rabbi to kind of patch up your way of relating to God, to tweak the system a little bit, to reform it slightly. He's saying, I'm here to inaugurate a fundamentally new way of relating to God. And I can't mix who I am and what I've come to inaugurate with your old system. They just won't mix. Now, that also is a claim to be the Messiah. We don't hear it as such, but they would have, because they knew that in the Old Testament, through the prophet Jeremiah, God said, the day is coming when my Messiah comes and he will inaugurate a new covenant, a whole new way of relating to me. And it won't be like the old way, with its emphasis on ritual observance. God says, in that day, my Messiah will make my spirit available to people, and so that my people will know me personally. They won't have to relate to me primarily through rituals. They'll know me in their hearts through my spirit. And he said, in that day, worshiping me won't be primarily keeping outward worship regulations. It will be having my spirit change your life from the inside out. And Jesus, through these two parables, is announcing, I'm the Messiah who is bringing in the whole new way to relate to God. And it won't fit into the way you relate to Him. And then he makes a comment that we'll come back to later. He says, and also, no one who drinks old wine seems to want the fresh and the new wine. The old is better, they say. And we'll come back to that. So this is Jesus' response to when they lodge this complaint about fasting. The next conflict escalates the tension. Here, the Pharisees level a formal charge against Jesus. One day, this is chapter 6, verse 1. One day, as Jesus was walking through some grain fields, his disciples broke off heads of wheat, and they rubbed off the husks in their hands, and they ate the grains. So this is a pretty common practice back then. I mean, they didn't have McDonald's and all that. And as you were out in the fields between villages, you just would often go through people's fields and you'd grab some wheat and do like this with the get rid of the chaff and eat the wheat germ. But some Pharisees said, so this is the first thing you need to notice, is they're out there in some rural area just minding their own business, going from one village to another. And it's like when the cop hides behind a billboard, you know. It's like they're out there and they're watching him. And all of a sudden, and he pulls him over. The sin police are here. And they start writing out tickets. And some Pharisees said, you shouldn't be doing that. It's against the law to work by harvesting grain on the Sabbath. And they start writing out the tickets. And actually, as you'll see, they were writing 4 tickets out for each of the 12 disciples. What's going on here? Okay. It has to do with keeping the Sabbath. In the Old Testament, God gave his people Israel the Sabbath law. And the Sabbath law, it was a provision for them. He said, you know, I want you to take one day off each week and just rest and enjoy yourself and your family. Give your animals a rest too. And so it was a provision for humane treatment of the animals and to give people rest. And it was a witness to the surrounding nations, because at this time, you know, people worked every day, all day, just to eke out subsistence. And God said, I want the other nations to look on to you and for them to see that their God provides for them as they trust him. Because I want them to learn about me too. Now, that same law also expressly permitted Jewish people to, as they went through the fields of their neighbors and fellow Israelites, to do what the disciples were doing. This was another law that was designed to stimulate generosity and to make provision, especially for the poor, who often just didn't have enough to eat. So they'd say, always leave some grain standing in the corners of your fields and let people do what the disciples did. Now, the Pharisees, they just were like, they're like the most anal people in the world. And it's like they just seized up over the commandment, you shall not work on the Sabbath. It's like, what's work? What exactly is? We got to know what work is. And God's like, you know, work, you know what work is. Just relax during the day. No, we got to know what work is. What exactly is work so that we can be sure we don't do that, so that we can be holy? And by this time, they had come up with 39 classifications of work, 39 categories of work. And each category contained hundreds of examples of what constituted that category of work. And according to their anal And man-made definition of work, the disciples were guilty of four different kinds of work, busted on four counts of Sabbath violation. They were guilty of reaping, as they pulled the wheat out, threshing, winnowing, as they got the husk off, and preparing food on the Sabbath as they ate it. And so that's the conflict. And this is no small deal, because in this day, if you were convicted of being one who promoted violating the Sabbath, that was potentially a capital crime, because you were a false teacher. So they're like, you are busted, buddy. Okay, now, what's fascinating is Jesus' response. Ever read through the Gospels and you see people like laid something on them? Try stopping, closing the book, holding your finger there and saying, how would I answer this? And then check your answer with Jesus. You're hardly ever right. I mean, if I were him, I'd be like, dudes, chill. Deuteronomy 23 says we're allowed to do this. Back off, Jack. That's not how he answered. Look how he answered. Jesus replied, haven't you ever read in the scriptures what King David did when he and his companions were hungry? We're like, well, you probably wouldn't have answered that because you don't know about this story, do you? Neither did I. He went into the house of God and he ate the special bread reserved for the priests alone and then gave some to his friends. And that was breaking the law too. Now this is remarkable. He's like, look, let me tell you about a parallel situation in the Old Testament that you claim to believe in. The parallel situation is this. David, who was the leader of his men, they were fleeing from Saul, who was persecuting. There's partly a parallel here too, right? They were kind of persecuting, fleeing from these guys. And he says, when David and his friends were fleeing from Saul and they were famished, they ran into the priests. And in the Old Testament worship of God, they were to make these loaves of bread and no one was to eat them. They were just to be offered up to God as a thank offering. And so David's like, dudes, man, we're starving. And our cause is righteous. What do you got to eat? And the priest said, well, all we got to eat are the consecrated loaves that no one's supposed to eat. But here, you eat them. And David ate them and he gave some to his buddies. And the text contains not one word of disapproval about the fact that they violated the ritual of the consecrated loaves. And he's like, we're not doing anything different from what David and his men did. And God didn't mind that. Here, by the way, we're not going to dwell on this, but here's one of the main points that should come out of these conflicts is that even in the Old Testament, which had a lot of rituals, God never, never, never meant for ritual observances to be viewed as more important than meeting people's needs. In the New Testament, there's far fewer rituals. But the principle that Jesus is getting at is that even in the ritualistic forms of the Old Testament, God always prioritized meeting people's needs more than worshiping him through rituals. So that's the first point. And then he lays this one on him. Besides, he says, I, the Son of Man, am master or Lord even of the Sabbath. Now I want you to notice a pattern developing here. They're PO'd with him about breaking their regulations. He never apologizes, explains himself, and includes a reference to his authority as the Messiah. Remember the last one? I'm the bridegroom. I'm the Messiah who's here to inaugurate the new way to relate to God. Here he's like, hey man, someone greater than David's here. I'm David's promised descendant. Messiah, I am the Son of Man. That's a messianic title from Daniel chapter 7, when Daniel in a vision sees this heavenly figure presented before God the Father and given the right to rule all the nations of the world. And here's Jesus saying, look, I'm the Son of Man, and that makes me the Master, the Lord, even of the Sabbath. Now, who created the Sabbath and its commandments? God. What is Jesus claiming? He's claiming to be Messiah and claiming to be divine or deity himself. So he's like, I think I know better how to interpret the law that I made to commemorate the Sabbath that I created than you do. Back off. Well, that escalates things. Conflict number three, chapter 6, verse 6. On another Sabbath day, a man with a deformed right hand was in the synagogue while Jesus was teaching. The teachers of religious law and the Pharisees watched closely to see whether Jesus would heal the man on the Sabbath, because they were eager to find some legal charge to bring against him. So here, they're actively seeking an indictment, a legal indictment against Jesus. And so they know that he's teaching at the synagogue. They know that this man with a crippled hand is there. Maybe they pushed the guy up to the front so that Jesus couldn't help but see him in the front row. They knew that he had a habit of healing people. They knew he didn't respect their Sabbath regulations. And they're like, man, here in a public arena, we're going to bust him out as violating the Sabbath and encouraging other people to do so. And we'll bring charges against him. That's the situation. It's a setup. They really got him now. Boy, that's a theme that you'll see in the gospel. We got him now. Here's how Jesus responds. But Jesus knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the deformed hand, this must have been a dramatic moment, come and stand here where everyone can see. No backing down. I mean, he could have taken him back in the closet afterwards and dealt with his hand. He said, come on up in front of everyone. You want a public event? We're going to have a public event. And then Jesus said to his critics, well, you know, they were on the edge of their seat now. I mean, the phone cameras were gone. And he says, I've got a question for you. Is it legal to do good on the Sabbath? Or is it a day for doing harm? Is this a day to save or restore a life? Because this man would have been unable to work. He would have been poverty stricken because of that. And to restore his hand is to restore his ability to work, to restore his life to him. Is it a day to save life or to destroy it? And you see what he's doing? They have him on the spot. He's now got them on the spot. Tell us, oh great religious one. Is the intent of the Sabbath? Is it okay on the Sabbath to use the resources that I have to do good to someone and restore his life to him? Or is the point of the Sabbath to withhold that and be party to destroying people's lives? That's interesting, isn't it? Jesus evidently believed that when he had the resources and the opportunity to do good to a person, that carried with it a responsibility to do good, and to not do good was actually to do evil. He didn't know that he'd ever see this man again. This was the time, the opportunity that he had. And so he what is he, and I don't want you to miss, and it says in Mark's gospel that he looked out at them and he was grieved as he looked at the religious leaders. It says he looked around them one by one, looked at each of their eyes after posing that question, and then said to the man, reach out your hand. And as the man reached out his hand, it was no longer crippled, no longer palsied. What a dramatic moment. And I want you to know that when Jesus looked at these guys after posing that question, it says he was grieved in heart. He did what he did not just to be ornery, an ornery nonconformist. He did what he did out of compassion for this man. He had the resources to help him, so he was going to help him. That's consistent with the spirit of the Sabbath, which was designed to provide for people's good anyway. And he posed this question and exposed the madness of their uptight system for their good. And that question was designed to hopefully shock them to their senses about the foolish grid that they had. And then he healed this man, validating his authority. And by the way, When he healed this man, he fulfilled a messianic prediction in Isaiah chapter 35, verse 6, where it teaches that when Messiah comes, he will heal the lame. And so he was not only helping this man, but he was once again claiming, I am here as the Messiah to do what only the Messiah can do. And their response, the enemies of Jesus were wild with rage. And they began to discuss what to do with him. And when it says they began to discuss what to do with him, it doesn't mean they wrung their hands like, oh, no. They're wild with rage because he's embarrassed them. There's a time and a place where it's a loving thing to embarrass someone. And we read in Mark's gospel that what this means is that they began to discuss how to eliminate Jesus. He has got to go. And they even began negotiating with their own enemies at this point, the Herodians, negotiating with their own enemies to find a way to get Jesus arrested and eliminated. Such a threat he was to them. And so from this point on, for the next 3 years, on one level, there's a certain cat and mouse game going on where they're trying to catch him so that they can bust him and get him eliminated. And Jesus eluding the traps that they set for him, giving them over and over again opportunities to revise the way they think about things until the time comes when it's time for him to fulfill prophetic scriptures by being arrested and crucified. Now, let's spend the rest of the time here this morning thinking about some lessons that this passage teaches us. And these lessons are related, as you'll see. The first and most obvious lesson from this passage is that Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. Each and every time that they... In each conflict, the heart of Jesus' response was to claim to be the Messiah. I'm the promised bridegroom. I'm the Messiah who comes to inaugurate the new covenant. I am David's promised Messiah descendant. I am Lord even over the Sabbath. I am the one who heals the lame, which the prophet said the Messiah would do. And so there is a very, very clear, very, very bold, very, very insistent claim to be the Messiah, the one, like the Matrix, you know, the Matrix, the one. It's that idea, not one of the many. The one predicted by the prophets to be the unique, divinely authoritative, rightful ruler of the whole human race. I'm that one. And so his basic message is, dude, I'm not under your authority. You're under my authority. I'm the Messiah. Deal with it. What part of what we see in this passage is the irrationality of these religious leaders? Because you would think that with the way that Jesus conducted himself, the way that he was fulfilling the prophets that they had memorized, you would think that they, and the clarity of his claims, you would think that they would consider revising their own theology, revisiting their own man-made rules, reconsidering them, and responding to him as the Messiah. But they didn't do that. And we're going to explore some of the reasons why they didn't do that in a minute. But I just don't want you to miss the main point. Man, the main point, folks, is Jesus of Nazareth, make no mistake about it, he never walked around claiming to be just one more moral teacher, one more wandering sage, one more avatar, one more one of many manifestations of the divine light, one more one of many ways to spiritual enlightenment. He always consistently claimed to be the one and only Messiah, the only way to God. And that is a disturbing claim. It's a polarizing claim. It's a claim that, you know, you have to react to. And in our culture, the most common irrational reaction to Jesus' claim is to just say, well, he never really said that. Well, we're just reading the statement of what the Christians 2 centuries later came to believe when they were in power and they were trying to get rid of people who knew the story about the real Jesus. And this is the thinking that lies behind the Da Vinci Code and stuff like that. And folks, listen, I made this point when we started this series, and I want to make it again. The four Gospels, they're the earliest records of the life of Jesus. They are first century documents. They are written by eyewitnesses, or in Luke's case, they are written as the compilation of eyewitnesses that he interviewed. These were people who suffered persecution and death for their claim in a multi-religious environment that Jesus is the only Lord. This is what Jesus really claimed about himself. We can be more certain that Jesus claimed to be the Messiah than we can about virtually any ancient historical event, because there's so much attestation by early eyewitnesses to what he claimed. This is what he claimed. And the notion that, no, he never really said that, something that someone else made up 2 centuries later, it's the height of irrationality. It's patently false. And that just has to be taken off the table. I mean, if you need more information on this, please come up afterwards and I'll give you places to check up on this. Because the point is, Jesus Christ claims to be your Messiah. He claims to be your Lord. And he said some audacious things. He said that he was the only way to God. He said that the way that you respond to him will determine your eternal destiny. And he calls on you in no uncertain terms to bow to him, to embrace him as the rightful leader of your life, and to surrender your life and the direction of your life to him. The evidence for his claim in terms of fulfilled prophecy, the quality of his life and his miracles, and the evidence for his resurrection is unsurpassed. No one ever made a claim like this. Buddha never made a claim like this. Buddha never said, I'm the one true way to God. Buddha said, I've found a way to enlightenment. Muhammad never claimed to be the Lord. As C.S. Lewis said, if you'd asked Muhammad, but are you the Lord? He would have first torn his garments as an expression of outrage for that blasphemy, and then he'd cut your head off. Jesus didn't make this statement in a pantheistic milieu where everyone says, well, we're all really God in our own special way. He made this claim in a highly monotheistic culture where everyone knew there was only one true God who existed separate from all creation. It's a polarizing claim, and it was meant to be. And he wants you to bow to his authoritative direction for your life. And he declares that not to do that is to ensure that your life will be an utter failure and ruin. Now, what are you going to do with that? Well, sometimes what you need to do is to go get more evidence whether Jesus really is who he claimed to be. And at the end of today, I'll put up on the screen a couple of books that we make available to you, especially if you're guests here. One of them is called Christianity, the Faith That Makes Sense. And it's an excellent collection of the evidence that Jesus is who he claimed to be. But you know what I find? I find that most times our reluctance to bow to Jesus as the leader of our lives is not really because of lack of evidence. Most of the time, I would say, it's not because of lack of evidence. There are usually other reasons that keep us from bowing to Jesus as the Messiah. And that's what the other two lessons in this passage, I think, can help us with. Here's lesson number two. You cannot read this passage without realizing that following Jesus has nothing, that should be underlined, capitalized, It already is italicized. Nothing to do with being an uptight, self-righteous religionist. I mean, you can't miss that, right? Who's the uptight, self-righteous religionist in this passage? The Pharisees. They're the sin police. They're the anal ones. They're the ones that, you know, delight in restricting people in every way that they can. Who is Jesus? Jesus hates that system. He's the one feasting, not fasting. He's the one having a great walk with his disciples, not writing tickets out. He's the one healing people, doing good to people on the Sabbath instead of being weird. You can't read this passage without realizing that Jesus was implacably opposed to uptight, self-righteous religion. He literally died over this issue. It literally cost him his life, his enmity against this. Now, why do I bring this up? Because I think this is often one of the main reasons why we're so reluctant to embrace Jesus as our Messiah. Because we believe if I do that, if I start following Jesus, I'm going to turn into an uptight, self-righteous religionist. Now, where'd you get that idea? Well, I know where I got it. I got it with my growing up with exposure to the church. You know, and that's the great and tragic irony of all ironies, that this movement, whose leader was a man who lived and died to liberate people from the straitjacket of this kind of religion, that something has arisen from that movement that is much more like the Pharisees than Jesus. And I know that this was one of the main reasons for I hated who I thought Jesus was, because I hated the religion that I had crammed down my throat as a kid, which was all about rituals that made no sense to me, which was all about weird rules and restrictions, like you're not allowed to eat candy from now until Easter. It's like, why? Because you're not. That's godly. It's like, you know, and it began with, you know, having to get up Sunday morning when I'd rather sleep and put on clothes that I didn't wear any other time and go to this building that smelled weird and listen to music that I didn't like and on and on and on. Why are we doing this? Shh, we're worshiping God. What kind of God? You see the point? And I knew that the holy people there knew that I didn't like this, and I sensed that they'd look down on me for not liking it. And so what gets set in motion is this whole, it becomes a visceral aversion to Jesus, when that isn't even who the real Jesus is. And man, if there's one thing that we have to do, those of us who follow Jesus, is to always be super aware of this. And what is he saying? He's saying, I came to inaugurate a whole new way of spirituality, and this way is centered around loving irreligious people like we saw last week, delighting in irreligious people because God delights in them. This whole way is centered around experiencing the love of God in your heart through His Spirit, and then learning to delight in giving God's love away to other people who need His love so desperately. That is the heart of Jesus's spirituality. And maybe you're here today and you got here because someone talked to you, told them, yeah, I'll come sometime. And then they badgered you until you finally, just to get them off their backs, you came, you know, and you're never going to come back again. And that's okay. It's a free country. But before you go, just remember, if you follow Jesus, if you surrender your life to Jesus as your Messiah, your leader, He is not going to turn you into an uptight, self-righteous religionist. He is going to lead you into a whole different way of life that centers around the love of God and loving other people. And maybe realizing that is enough to open your heart up to Him and to say to Him, you know what, if that's what you want to lead me into, I'm in. Now, there's another reason why so many people are aversive to surrendering to Jesus as their Messiah, even when they've got evidence, even when they realize it's not about religion. And It's the little statement that Jesus made in chapter 5, verse 39. Do you remember that statement? He said, people who drink the old wine, they seem to want, don't seem to want the fresh and the new wine. They say, you know, the old is better. And so I'm calling this comfortable conservatism. And I want to take just a few minutes to explain this to you, because I really think that this is often the most common reason why people don't meet Christ and have their lives changed by him. When I speak of conservatism here, I'm not talking about a political position. Comfortable conservatism has nothing to do with it. It cuts across all different political persuasions. I'm talking about that deeply ingrained human tendency to resist change, to preserve the status quo because it's familiar to me and it's comfortable to me. We like to poke fun at older people. You know, I know an older guy, and he still writes letters on a typewriter. I mean, it just cracks me up. So why does he do that? Because the prospect of dealing with this thing called a computer, and not only that thing, but learning this whatever software is, this program, that's so intimidating that even though he hears about the advantages that he could gain in writing efficiency, what does he say? I think I'll stick with the typewriter. I like the old wine. Right? It's familiar to me. I'm comfortable with it. We call people like that set in their ways. It's not a compliment. But you know, whether you use a typewriter or learn Microsoft Word, there's really very little consequence to that. What Jesus is warning us about is the comfortable conservatism that makes us aversive to letting him change our lives. That even though we may be prepared to admit my life is not super fulfilling, it's not really what I had hoped that it would be, as one friend told me one time long ago, yeah, I know my life is a mud puddle, but at least it's my mud puddle. And I'm familiar with it. What is that? That's comfortable conservatism. That's saying, I like the old wine. And it's interesting, you know, the Pharisees here, what he's saying to them is that, look, you know, the reason they rejected Jesus and didn't become his followers is not because he didn't show them all kind of evidence that he was the Messiah. He showed them incredible evidence. The reason they didn't become his followers is not because he was some destructive guy that they were afraid of. I mean, he was not going around, you know, beating people up and ruining people's days. He was saving lives. The redemptive power of God to change people's lives for the good was on display through Jesus. And he says, watch out. Watch out. Watch out for your comfortable conservatism. Because he knew that they had lived this way for so long. And their identity was bound up in the way they related to God through these regulations. And they realized, and they were right when they realized, if we open our hearts to the possibility that he's the way, then our lives are going to change. It's going to change the way we relate to God. It's going to change what we teach. It's going to change the way people look at us. We might have to admit that we were wrong for many, many years about the most important thing. I like the old wine better. You know, I think this is the main reason why people who've been involved and who've been deeply religious for many years are the hardest people to bring to Christ. I'll never forget, as a young Christian, I think I'd only known Christ for a few months, and I was working, painting this lady's house, and we got into a talk over lunch, and she, I don't know how we got on the subject, but I just was telling her, man, it is so cool. I have met Christ, and he's changed my life. I was telling her how he got me off of drugs, and I now knew that God was loving, and I think I probably said, and I realized that all that stuff I did growing up, I realized didn't really matter. And I was, I'm sure, aglow, and all of a sudden her face wrinkled up like a dried prune. And she was like, are you telling me that all of the church services, et cetera, and rituals and things that I've done all these years don't really count toward being accepted by God? And I was like, yeah, isn't that great? You don't have to do any of that stuff. You can be in just the way you are if you meet Christ. And she was offended. What was she saying? I like the old wine. I'm used to this. It's familiar to me. I've got a lot invested in this. I would have to be willing to admit that that really wasn't the way to find God. And I would have to be ready to let God change me in this area. I don't know what happened to her. I hope that God used our brief conversation. You know what? It's not just religious people. You know, statistically, that the percentage of people in America who make decisions to embrace Jesus as their Messiah drops after the age of 17. The vast majority of people in this country who meet Christ meet him before the age of 18. Now, why is that? Is that because young people are just so naive? Or is it this tendency to become comfortably conservative? And whether you're religious or not, as you figure out how to survive in this world, in this broken world, and make your life, that you get locked into that. And even though you may sit here today and say, man, I know my life is not anything close to what I'd hoped that it would be. At least it's my mud puddle. At least I'm familiar with it. At least I know how to manage in this environment. And what Jesus is saying is, please don't let that attitude cause you to forfeit the opportunity to experience the new life that he wants to give you. If you open your heart to Jesus Christ, and if you surrender to him as your Messiah and tell him that you want him to lead your life now, your life will change. It'll change in more ways than you can imagine, and it will change more profoundly than you can even get your arms around. But it's a good change. It's a change from relating to God as an abstract, distant authority figure to knowing God as a God of love, who's your own heavenly Father. It's a change from relating to your own failures by rationalizing them or blaming other people or casting yourself as a victim and being embittered toward the people who hurt you to being able to forgive other people the way that Christ has forgiven you and to love people and not be enslaved to your own bitterness. It's a change from having to make your world smaller and smaller as the years go by so that you can retain some semblance of control, to where you realize, I have someone out ahead of me who really knows where he's going. And life is an adventure because Jesus is with me and he loves me and he proves his faithfulness to me. Don't let comfortable conservatism, whether it's religious conservatism or just the conservatism of your own mud puddle, don't let that hold you back from discovering the new life that Jesus Christ wants to give you. You can do that today. And all you have to do is to cry out to him in your own heart and say, I'm ready. I'm scared, but I'm ready to take that step and let you take over the reins. Maybe before you even need to do that, you need to just talk to someone, one of your friends, maybe that brought you here, who knows Christ. You're going to probably find that they were really afraid of this change as well. Ask them, were you afraid? How did you get past that fear of change? Why are you glad that you made that decision? You won't regret it. You won't regret it. All right. Next week, we got a real treat for you. A study on Mephibosheth. I doubt strongly that even after the teaching, that you'll be tempted to name your next child Mephibosheth. But Mephibosheth is a delightfully interesting character, one of Saul, King Saul's children. And there is a relationship between Mephibosheth and David in the Old Testament that is, it's got such sweet lessons for us. So that's what we're going to look at next week. All right, let's pray. Jesus, thank you for making it clear that you claim to be the Messiah, that you claim to be the rightful leader of our lives. Thank you that you make it clear that if we follow you, you will not turn us into uptight, self-righteous religionists, but that you will set us free to know God's love and to give God's love to other people. And thank you, Lord, that you are ready to help us move past our fear of change. I thank you, Lord, that you you help me to realize that if there was a chance for my life to be better, if there was a chance for my life to have the kind of meaning and significance and hope that I'd hoped that it would have, that it was worth taking the risk to open the door and to ask you to come into my life and take the leadership of my life. I thank you that you've never disappointed me. I thank you that the only regrets that I have are when I've not trusted you. And Lord, I pray that you will help each person here today who is at that place where they realize the main thing holding them back is just the fear that you might change their lives. And just help them, Lord, to take hold of this offer and to say, Jesus, come into my life. I acknowledge you as my rightful leader. Forgive me for being a fugitive from you all these years. Thank you for your love and grace. Now lead me into the new life that you promise. Thank you that you always answer that. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.